Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Rules Committee. It is 3:05 and the 21st day of February. And we're going to start out with a work session, and we're going to have invited testimony. It's on SCR 205, and ask Representative Tomei to come up and share. Cheyenne, if you would.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, SCR 205 is the memorialization of Betty Roberts. We schedule work sessions on the memorializations because they've had a full hearing on the Senate side, but appreciating that Representative Tomei wanted to speak to this one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. Thank you for allowing me to speak on Senate Concurrent Resolution 205 honoring Betty Roberts. Betty Roberts is one of my heroes, and I know there was a lot of testimony on the Senate side and much celebration, and I just could not bear it coming through this committee without someone saying what a wonderful woman she was and how lucky we were to have her in our state. Betty Roberts was elected as a state representative in 1964. In 1968, she was elected to the Oregon Senate. And in 1977, she was appointed by Governor Straub to the Oregon Court of Appeals, and she was the first woman to serve as appellate judge in the state's history. Not only that, in 1982, Governor Vicatia appointed her to the Supreme Court, and again, she was the first woman in the history of the state of Oregon to serve on the Supreme Court. One of the most important things she did a lot of important things, but one of the most important things she did was a landmark opinion, which was Hewitt versus Safe, which established, colleagues, that men and women are equal under the Oregon Constitution. What an amazing statement that this court found, that men and women in Oregon are equal under the Oregon Constitution. Betty Roberts, as I said, is one of my heroes. We lost her just fairly recently. It's appropriate that we honor her in this building where she honored us by her presence. Thank you for allowing me to speak on this concurrent resolution, and thank you, committee.
Thank you, Representative Tomei. Jefferson. Representative Jefferson Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jefferson Smith, serving the State House in District 47 in East Portland. I want to add my words to those of Representative Tomei. Betty Roberts was an Oregon pioneer. All of you know that already, so I will be brief. From 1958 to 1967, she taught at East County at Reynolds High School, Centennial High School, and David Douglas High School, each of those districts overlapping with mine, before moving on to teach business, law, and political science at Mount Hood Community College. Many of my current and former constituents were inspired to being involved in public affairs to some degree through the lessons of Betty Roberts. Since then, I watched as she inspired not only a next generation of women, but also a next generation of young leaders. I used to run a nonprofit organization. She was generous with her time in appearing at events and in doing trainings, and inspires, hopefully, those of us here to stay committed to public affairs even after we leave official position. And her willingness to not, you know, go away and peddle influence, but to still be committed to the public interest showed the highest standard, I think, of public service that there is. Appreciate you taking this up and for giving us a few minutes.
Thank you. Any questions, committee? Okay, thank you. Anyone else in the audience that would like to speak to SCR 205? Okay, I'm going to close a work session on that, and I'm going to wait for Representative Berger?
I'm just
going to
move it.
Well, actually, I'm going to wait for Representative Holvey. He'll be here shortly. I know he wanted. Okay. So I'm going to close the work session right now on SCR 205, and I am going to. What we're going to do is go through the public hearings first, members, and then from there we'll move into the work sessions. So I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 4173.
Chairs and members of the committee, House Bill 4173 permits printing names of political parties and the word incumbent, if applicable, with candidate name on ballot instead of specifying printing opposite or following the candidate's name, declares an emergency effective on passage. There is also a dash one amendment that was received today that permits the use of three-letter abbreviations in lieu of the entire party name.
You guys want it.
Okay, Mike Ellison, if you'd come up, and Tim Scott.
Co-Chair Olson, Co-Chair Kotek, members of the committee, Michael Eisen, Association of Oregon Counties. I'm just briefly speaking in support of House Bill 4173. This bill makes a little housekeeping cleanup to the Fusion Light bill that passed, I believe, in 2009. At the time, the statute currently says party names should be printed opposite the candidate's name. County election offices were not able to do that at the time, get all of the party names opposite the candidate's name, so instead have been printing underneath, and this simply cleans that up to say that the candidates, or party names should be printed with the candidate's name, allowing the printing underneath. Which is current practice. We've also introduced for your consideration, a dash one amendment that would more or less continue what's been current practice, which is allowing three-letter abbreviations of party names along with a key, an explanatory key, that has a more full pronunciation or full party name. So we're hoping that you will take that under advisement and pass that amendment into the bill. Essentially, without doing that, when this Fusion Light statute was passed allowing for three party names, counties cannot fit all three party names on one line, which essentially wraps down to a second line. If you get enough of those, it increases the likelihood of a second page of the ballot, which would essentially double the cost of the election. So with that, we think that we've now had established some history with the three-party abbreviations. Counties across the state have not received any complaints or any confusion from voters who weren't comfortable with that or didn't understand what the three-letter abbreviation meant. So we'd just like to see that continue on. And with that, I'll close and turn it over to Tim Scott.
Thank you, Representative Olson, Representative Kotek, members of the committee. My name is Tim Scott. I'm the Director of Elections for Multnomah County. Mike got that right, so I don't have a whole lot to add. Just basically that I wanted to state that we have long ballots in Oregon. They're often crowded, especially the primary and general ballots. The general election ballot is what we're talking about here. 32 of the 36 counties use the same voting system, and that voting system can only go to a 17-inch ballot. That's the longest ballot we can get before we have to go to a two-page ballot. In November 08, we actually had to go to a 17-inch ballot from a 14-inch ballot to examine the possibility of printing three full party names underneath the ballot or underneath the candidate's name on the ballot. I had our ballot printer examine our 2008 ballots, which were already maxed out on several ballot styles. And I won't say that all of the ballot styles went over to two pages, but some of them certainly did. And just some of the issues that go along with a two-page ballot are twice the expense for printing on those ballot styles that do go over to two pages, extra costs associated with creating the outgoing ballot packets, extra costs to the voter for return postage, extra costs to process the two-page return packet, and extra complexity for tracking the returned ballots. You essentially go from a ballot packet that has two possible states, either there's a ballot enclosed or there's not a ballot enclosed, to one that has four possible states, no ballot enclosed, both pages enclosed, page one enclosed or page two enclosed. And we have to keep track of all of those pieces of paper for the reconciliation of the election. I also wanted to point out that abbreviating on the ballot is something that we have done. We have made adjustments using abbreviations in the past. Because we have so many referenda and initiative on the ballot, we have been allowed to abbreviate the measures on the ballot, essentially, by printing the title and the explanatory statement. And then we actually do a separate piece of paper that has the full text of the measure, which was what we call a measure flyer that gets inserted with your ballot. So there is some precedent for this. Am I going to say that not having the three-letter abbreviations is going to mean huge costs and everybody going to a two-page ballot in the general election? No. But it's just one of those things that we can do to help save space on an already crowded ballot. So I would urge you to consider the Dash 1 amendments as well as the cleanup on the measure. Thank you very much.
Okay. Questions? Representative Chair Kotek.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Thank you for being here today, and I support the underlying bill, 4173, to give you more flexibility. The opposite language clearly didn't work. I just want to talk about the Dash 1 amendment a moment. I know we have been doing abbreviations. I think one of my concerns with this is that it allows you to do this, but I'm just curious what the thought process is from the clerks. At what point do you say the interests of the voter having seen the whole party listed versus an abbreviation? Where, you know, I wouldn't want this to be the automatic default to say we're just going to do abbreviations. We've done it in the past. It saves us time and money and space. I mean, I would like to make sure that the clerks are having a conversation and say, okay, the need for folks to see the party written out should be what we should try to achieve. If we can't, we have other options, but I wouldn't want this to be the default. Do you have any comment on that?
Sure. Representative Kotek, members of the committee, the clerks support a common sense approach, something like we have done. I won't get into the history of the three-letter abbreviations. I'm sure you'll hear from other folks that will talk to you about that. We were allowed to use the three-letter abbreviation in the November 10 election, and then for the last two elections that at least Multnomah County and four other counties have been involved in, we've used the full party name. And that was essentially because there was no possibility, because of the size of the election ballot with only one issue for the Congressional District 1 special election, there was no possibility that ballot could run to two pages, so we were allowed to use, or we used the full party name. You know, in the conversations that I've had with the clerks on this issue, there was almost unanimous support of a common sense approach to this, meaning if that's the difference between a two-page ballot, then we'll go to the abbreviations.
And if not, then we would stay with the full listing if we could.
Sure. And the clerks, let me just say that the clerks actually supported the original version of the Light Fusion bill, which said no more than two party names. We sat down and put a lot of thought into what we could do back in 2009, and we determined we can do party names, and we can do it without adding length to the ballot. And that was our initial support of that. Of this system of voting was based on two party names. Once it went to three, we just ran out of space quickly and it started adding to the length of the ballot.
Thank you. I appreciate the clarification.
Representative Garrett.
Thank you. Sorry I missed this, but I don't see language specifying how the three-letter abbreviation would be chosen. For some parties, it may be obvious. For some parties, it may not. And we could have different abbreviations in different counties. Presumably. Does that create any concerns?
Well, Representative Garrett, members of the committee, the way we used abbreviations in the past was based on a rule by the Secretary of State's office, and an accompanying key went along with the rule. I imagine that if this were to pass, that in order to provide some uniformity by rule, we would also seek to have some standardization throughout the state.
Thank you.
You know, before, why don't you guys stop right there? I'm going to ask Steve Trout if he'd come up then, because that might kind of catch up a little bit of your question, and it might fit in a little bit better with the direction where this testimony is going right now.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Steve Trout, State Election Director, here in support of House Bill 4173. And again, as Mr. Eliason has pointed out, this is simply to provide statutory support for the existing voting systems that we have within the state to enable us to print the party names on the ballot and to be able to fully implement the cross-nomination process. So with respect to Representative Garrett's question about rulemaking, This is an amendment that has been put forward by the County Clerks Association. We don't have any opposition to it, but really we're here to push the underlying bill. If the dash ones were adopted, then what was done during the last election cycle was I invited each of the qualified political parties within the state to provide me the three-letter abbreviation that they desired, and those are the ones that we used.
Continue.
Let me ask a specific question. REP could be Republican or it could be Representative. Does that lead to a potential confusion on the part of voters?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garrett, we didn't have any calls of confusion or any evidence of confusion in 2010 when we used REP for Republicans.
So it's a follow-up. It's up to the party to choose whatever three-letter, if we go forward, it would be up to the party to choose the three-letter acronym it wants to be known by.
Mr. Chair, Representative Garrett, that's one way to do it. I mean, you could put it in the statute if that's what you want to do, but then you've got new parties that would be added, and there would be some complexity there. So that was the way I chose to do it, trying to give the parties the best opportunity to identify themselves on the ballot in 2010 when we did this. And so by rule, that would be my intention if the circumstances arose again.
Okay, thank you.
Anybody else? Okay. Hey, thank you, gentlemen. Okay. Now I'd like to invite Steve Hughes, Ruth Bendel, and Dan Meek, please.
You go ahead, Dan.
Ruth, go ahead. You're letting Dan go first? Oh. Okay.
Good afternoon, Mr. Co-Chair. My name is Dan Meek. I represent here the Independent Party of Oregon. We don't oppose the underlying bill, but we certainly do oppose the Dash 1 amendments, and I would note the process that is being used to bring those to you. There's no public notice whatsoever of the Dash 1 amendments. And so I was here not even knowing that they would be discussed, and no member of the public could possibly know that this would be discussed. As to the underlying bill, it's really not necessary because the counties have for many decades printed the names of the parties beneath the names of the candidates in any event. The term opposite has never been interpreted to mean horizontal opposite. That is, opposite can just means at the other end of an axis. It can be a horizontal axis. It can be a vertical axis. So a name of a party is opposite the name of a candidate if it is to the right of the candidate or if it's below the candidate. It's simply one axis is vertical, is horizontal, the other axis is vertical. And I have several examples of that going back to elections in 2008, 2004, from several different counties, and as soon as I staple these together, I'll give them to the clerk so that you can see that many of the party names are listed below the candidate, and that's under the existing statute calling for the names to be opposite, because as I say, opposite means vertically opposite or horizontally opposite. As far as the Dash 1 amendments go, the Secretary of State and Attorney General filed a memorandum 4 days ago in Marion County Circuit Court stating that it is not necessary in any county to abbreviate the names of the parties. It states, in February of 2001, Lane County, which was the only county which claimed that it would have a problem in listing the names of the parties on its ballots, signed a contract to change their voting machine systems to one which allows printing party names below the candidate's name. That switchover was completed during the summer of 2011. By making the switch, Lane County is now able to print cross nominations using the traditional one- or two-word abbreviations. We're not talking about three-letter abbreviations. Of course, words are not abbreviations in any event. This is a change from 2010, when they were physically unable to do so because of the constraints of their system. In January 2012, the Secretary of State formally repealed the three-character abbreviation rule. That is, the Secretary of State has concluded that there's no need for the three-letter abbreviation rule and has repealed the rule. So I don't see why folks are here now asking for that to be reinstated. By the way, that has never been the practice in Oregon to use abbreviations, particularly three-letter abbreviations, to identify parties of the candidates. It has been done exactly once, and that was in 2010, pursuant to a rule that was adopted by the Secretary of State in late August of 2010, was not published until September of 2010, and by then it was too late for the minor parties to obtain an injunction to prevent it from going into effect. There is, however, still a lawsuit in Marion County Circuit Court challenging the asserted authority of the Secretary of State to use three-letter abbreviations, and the Secretary of State is asserting to the court as of last week that it still has authority to make the ballots have three-letter abbreviations, which indicates that this bill, in the view of the Attorney General and Secretary of State, in the words that they presented to the court last week, isn't necessary in any event. Finally, you've heard from a couple of folks saying no one complained about the abbreviations on the ballot. I'm not aware of any process for presenting such a complaint. I would find the names on the ballot, the abbreviations on the ballot, to be confusing. In the 2010 general election, the candidates on the ballot were identified with the following abbreviations: PRO, CON, WFP, LBT, PGP, IND, and NAV. In the first congressional district, one candidate had the PRO label, PRO, while another candidate had the CON label, CON. What was the PRO candidate for, and what was the CON candidate against? Now, most voters probably know what the labels DEM or REP would mean, although, as Representative Garrett pointed out, maybe REP means that the candidate is the incumbent representative. Maybe CON means that it's the candidate of the conservative party. What about PGP? It sounds like some sort of a street drug. Or does that refer to the new progressive party, PGP? No, it doesn't. It refers to the Pacific Green Party. What is an LBT? Some sort of sandwich with lettuce, bacon, and tomato? Is NAV the Navajo party, or was the candidate serving in the Navy? And WFP, what does that mean? I don't think a lot of voters know. Finally, there's a new group out there that has stated it already has more than enough signatures to create another minor party in Oregon, and that will be called, presumably, the Americans Elect Party. How would you abbreviate that? AME, what does that mean? AEL? I don't know. So I think there is no reason for the bill, the Dash 1 amendments. We oppose the Dash 1 amendments. We also think there's actually no reason for the bill at all, because party names have been printed below the candidate names for decades in Oregon. Let me take a look at my notes for a second. That looks like about it. Thank you.
Okay, Ruth.
Good afternoon. My name is Ruth Bendel. I'm the Voter Integrity Chair for the Washington County Republican Party. I won't go into the confusion aspect. I think you've had that explained very well by Mr. Meek. But I do resent discussion about saving money when there is so much waste already in the system that should be addressed before we talk about clarity for the voters, not all of whom are fully informed, just as Mr. Meek has explained. I'll give you an example of waste that we should have dealt with a long time ago, and that is sending ballots to people who have not complied with rules. They're called hover non-compliance.
Ruth, yes. You're taking us down a different bunny trail right now. I don't want to listen to it. I'd like to stay with what the concept of the bill is, okay?
Well, I'll make it very brief that I don't want to in any way confuse voters who are not fully informed about party affiliations. Thank you.
I get where you're at. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Steve Hughes. I'm the state director of the Oregon Working Families Party. We're here today also to speak against the Dash 1 amendments. We share some of the same concerns about this becoming the default setting for county elections offices to administer elections. I would like to just sort of give the brief history of what brought us here in the process. In 2009, the Oregon legislature, as you many well know, re-legalized fusion voting in the state. And that was a three-year effort. There was a lot of public process that went into that, a lot of discussions with you and with other members of the legislature. This Dash 1 amendment takes a significant step backwards in undoing all that work, and it does so with very little public process. Sitting here today as a representative of a party with one of the more difficult to remember acronyms, this is an issue for us personally, but I think more generally speaking, it's an issue that goes to voters having all the information when they cast their ballots. The issues of cost were discussed during the process, and what this legislative body found that those did not outweigh the issues of voters having as much information as possible on the ballot. I take issue with the idea that this is in some way just codifying the existing practice. In fact, the existing practice right now is a subject of litigation, as Dan Meek brought up. So to say that this is somehow just a housekeeping measure, I think mischaracterizes what's going on a little bit. So I think we are here to, I think, speak specifically about the bigger picture also, which is the Oregon Constitution holds that parties have the right to identify themselves by the name that communicates their philosophy publicly. And WFHP, in our case, doesn't communicate all that much. Working Families communicates a whole lot more. And for us, it's very important. And I think for the voters of this state, it's very important to maintain the ability for parties to be listed by their full name. And we stand here in opposition to the Dash 1 amendments. Thank you.
Okay. Questions? Okay. Very good. Thank you very much.
Mr. Co-Chair, if I may, just briefly. I just want to say for the record that you'll notice that this bill was only scheduled for public hearing today. I will say that while this is a very time-intensive schedule, the Dash 1s, you had a chance. We're not working this bill today, so I think the idea that somehow we're trying to slide in an amendment is not appropriate, so I just want to say that. Second thing I would say is that if we're not able to move this bill, I think proponents of the Fusion Light bill need to sit down and talk with the clerks about whether two parties is better than three or vice versa. There are financial aspects of this that I think, with all due respect, people are not really addressing. Regardless if you don't like abbreviations, I think, you know, this is an experiment. We want to get it right. We want it to work, but we also want to make it work in a way that actually makes sense for the county clerk. So I just want to say, if we don't deal with this, I would hope that parties sit down and talk about this for 2013. Thank you.
May I, Mr. Chair, Mr. and Ms. Co-Chair?
Go ahead, Dan.
May I ask a question?
May I ask a question?
Go ahead.
Will there then be another hearing on the Dash 1 amendment?
What we're planning on doing is moving the bill to Thursday. Now, whether we do anything at all with it, we're going to do some further discussion between us right now from what we're hearing today.
I'm just trying to ascertain when the opportunity, if, you know, if this wasn't the opportunity or the only opportunity for public input on the Dash 1 amendments, I'm trying to figure out when the other opportunity is.
Well, today is the day for the Dash 1 amendments.
Thank you.
Okay, you're going to close a public hearing on House Bill 4173. And members are going to move that for a possible work session public hearing further up with it on Thursday, that bill. And then we're going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 4174.
Chairs and members of the committee, House Bill 4174 modifies the requirements of county election security plans to include the number and location of any video cameras located where ballots may be tallied and a post-election record of total ballots printed, received, mailed, issued in person, returned, undeliverable, tallied, used for duplication, and archived, as well as the number of rejected ballot envelopes and the number of test envelopes. Modifies the requirements for each county's post-election disposition of duplicate ballots and unused ballots, and it modifies a number of provisions governing absentee ballots, declares an emergency as effective on passage. Excuse me. There's also a set of Dash 3 amendments that make minor modifications only on pages 1 and 2 of the bill, renumbering Section 1, deleting the total number of ballots received from inclusion in the post-election record, rewording the language regarding post-election disposition of unused ballots. The Dash 4 amendment adds provisions at the end of the bill to permit registered voters not affiliated with a party to vote in a party's primary, and that sunsets January 2nd, 2015.
Okay.
2013, I'm sorry. That's a typo.
Okay. As we move forward into this bill, you should probably know again, and it's kind of reciprocate a little bit with what Chair Kotek mentioned, this is just a public hearing. I greatly appreciate the work that Representative Garrett has worked on this, as well as Representative Wingard. I think it's a good starting point for us, but at this point right now, I'm not planning on moving this bill. I just want you to know that. There's been some great barriers that have been broken down in the process of the discussion through everyone that's been involved. So basically, for those of you who are going to be invited to come up and testify, know that as you're sharing, you know, come up and sharing that what's happening with the direction of this bill today. So with that, I'm just going to start from the top. And Ruth Bendel, if you'd come up again, Bev Hawes. And Wendy Fromm.
Again, I'm Ruth Bendel, Washington County Republican Party Voter Integrity Chair. House Bill 4174 is a second attempt to either repeal or amend the statute ORS 254.483, which is a vital electoral safeguard mandate, and it requires, and we want this to stay in place, it requires and mandates that all unused ballots get destroyed immediately after 8 p.m. on election day evening. We do not understand why anybody would want to have unused ballots floating around at elections offices. That's a golden rule that I've learned many years ago. No unused ballots, no undeliverable unused ballots that have been returned, because they run into the tens of thousands now with vote by mail. And we really question why anybody would be wanting to in any way diminish the impact of this ORS. And I've heard that because ballots that have problems need to be duplicated. No, they don't. I've already heard from county clerks indirectly that they are more than happy to have a tally sheet for reading the problem ballot and entering it onto the tally sheet, that vote. If you can interpret what the vote is, you can enter that on a tally sheet. One line is for the issues and candidates, and the other is the number that will go on the ballot that's being interpreted. You keep that ballot with the tally sheet, and the county clerk will enter those results into the with the reconciliation process. So again, I question why there's an effort to diminish ORS 254.483. And seeing as we're all talking about the need for transparency when it comes to procedures, there is no transparency when the results are done over 3 weeks with regard to the unused ballots, and the only person that knows those results is the Secretary of State. We have people that take their time to be observers at the elections offices, and they're not there for decorative purposes. They want to be able to verify what's going on. They're not going to sit around for 3 weeks, and 3 weeks is way too long for tens of thousands of unused ballots to be floating around at elections offices. I suggest if you want to do anything permanent with HB 4174, you remove anything to do with ORS 254.483. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Whitty.
Co-Chair Kotek and Co-Chair Olson and members of the committee, I'm Wendy Froman. I'm from Albany, Oregon, and I won't go through all of the testimony that I prepared because I think it was sent to each of you, and especially since this bill will not be moving forward. I think that what Ruth said is that we really want to move towards more secure elections and not away from secure elections. And by taking away one of our safeguards, having ballots sitting in offices for weeks, that they need to be destroyed as soon as the polls close, so that there's no suspicion of voter fraud. And I know that we need a few extra ballots around, but I think the solution to this problem is destroy those ballots. As soon as the ballots are mailed to our registered voters, destroy all the rest of them. And then if we need ballots for substituting or, you know, for some legitimate reason, print some ballots up in a very obvious color paper so that election observers who are there watching the election, the processing of the ballots, are very clear on this is a ballot that because a voter lost his ballot or coffee was spilled on the ballot, they need a new ballot. Okay, that red piece of paper going through the machine is one of those ballots. Then there's no reason to hold on to those boxes of extra ballots that are stored in the closet that need to be pulled out when they're needed. I think one of the things that we're getting away from, and especially with vote by mail, is public oversight. It's next to impossible because of the time frame of those ballots being handled. They're handled for weeks, and so we're losing a lot of faith in the integrity of our elections. And this bill, 4174, proposes new security procedures, which it's great to have new procedures in place, but the biggest problem that I see and many that I've talked to are that the procedures are not subject to public oversight. In House Bill 4174, on page 2, lines 6 through 7, it states that the procedures are confidential and not subject to public disclosure. This is unacceptable. It's like telling someone that is buying a used car that it isn't necessary to look under the hood, just trust the seller. Now, we want to trust people, but we need to be able to verify what is happening. And I would think every county clerk would want to have that happen as well. They have difficult jobs. They need to be able to do their jobs, and they don't want people accusing them of voter fraud. A question I do want to ask, though, is why are the county clerks having to print thousands of extra ballots? Are our voter lists that inaccurate that we have to have that many ballots? Some of the unused ballots that are in the that are coming back to the election offices are ballots that are undeliverable. They're mailed out. The voter no longer lives there, so the post office is returning those. That's a problem with ballot security as well. And we could also save thousands of dollars if we in printing costs, postage, and even the staff handling all these unneeded ballots if we would destroy them when the law requires. I think I just want to close with we're counting on our elected officials to take every step to keep our elections secure. And one of the most important things is having public oversight. We can't have it so it's stretched out that the public, it's impossible for them to watch the elections. And the state law in place right now protects our vote by destroying these ballots in a timely manner. Please, and I think it's already been decided that this bill will not move forward. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks. Bev?
My name is Bev Hames, and I concur with what Ruth had to say and Wendy. I'm not going to go through my testimony except to say that I would really like to see that the Oregon Revised Statutes 254.483 stay as it is. Thank you.
Okay, any questions? Okay, thank you very much. Okay, if Steve Kraut, Tim Scott, and Andrew Nesbitt would come up. Andrew, why don't we just start with you, because you've listed yourself as neutral, so we can kind of just taper down here. Yeah.
If it's not moving forward, I have only two concerns, one of which is sort of minor and technical, and that is if all the unused ballots are going to be destroyed at date certain, be it at the moment at 8 p.m. on election day.
I'm sorry, would you identify yourself?
Yeah, I'm terribly sorry. Andrew Nesbitt, Portland, Oregon.
Okay, thank you.
If all the ballots are going to be destroyed at date certain, it might be nice if the status of archived ballots were somehow taken into account at that point, because if they aren't, then the ballot, I know that Multnomah County does, I assume all other counties do, retain a set of unused ballots for archival purposes, and that doesn't seem to be taken into account in the language that I was reading. It does concern me that we are adding a section about the location of video cameras, and we have yet to bother to insist that the security report include security for the computers that actually count up and total what's going on. In Multnomah County, it would be the Unity machine. We don't know what's on that machine when the election starts. We don't know what's on the machine when the election is finished. We don't have a log to keep track of who accessed the machine during the election. Except for a time that I did it myself, I don't think the results of that machine are checked against the various tally machines. I would think that the security of the computers that actually do the math should also be part of the security report. And that's it for me.
Okay. Thank you very much. Tim?
Thank you, Co-Chair Olson and Co-Chair Kotek, members of the committee. My name is Tim Scott, Multnomah County Director of Election, here today representing Oregon Association of County Clerks. I just want to thank the committee for taking the time to hear the testimony on this. As I spend quite a bit of time talking about it with my observers like Mr. Nesbitt here and Janice Deisinger, who's in the back of the room. The bill is very simple. It deals with elimination of language that is in direct conflict with another provision of the same statute. While it does other things, that's what most people are talking about here today. 254.483 says that immediately after 8 p.m. on the day of an election, Section 1 says the county clerk shall destroy all unused absentee and regular ballots in the county clerk's possession. That's what everybody's talking about here today. Section 2 of that actually says each county shall provide for the security of and shall account for unused ballots. So on the one hand, we're being told that we should destroy all the ballots at 8 o'clock, and on the other hand, we're being told that we should account for all those unused ballots. If county elections offices were to comply with Section 1 of this statute, it would be impossible to comply with Section 2. We cannot account for ballots that have been destroyed. Most people that I've spoken to about the conflict with these two statutes say they much prefer a thorough accounting of the unused ballots over a random destruction of the ballots at a certain time. And in Multnomah County, we provide a very thorough accounting of the unused ballots. We close as close to 8 p.m. on election night as possible in the presence of any observers that wish to witness the process. We lock the ballot storage area, place tamper evident seals over the locks on the ballot storage area, record the seal numbers, allow the observers to inspect the seals, and sign the certification form containing the seal numbers. We also provide copies of the certification document to the observers. Once we have certified the election, we check the seals for any evidence of tampering, check that the seal numbers match the witness certification sheet, remove the seals, unlock the unused ballots, and count the unused ballots. We then compare the number of unused ballots against the expected number based on the number ordered and the number used. If the numbers match, we shred the unused ballots. To add to this security of the blank ballots, Multnomah County will actually be adding 3 security cameras in our unused ballot storage area that will be operational by the primary election cycle. If unused ballots were taken from the storage area and somehow used to manipulate the results of the election, it would be apparent immediately and we would take appropriate action. In Multnomah County, we have a very active observer community, and I spend a lot of time talking to them about our processes and how we could improve them. As Andrew can testify to, many of the processes we have implemented in the almost 4 years that I have been director of Multnomah County Elections have been their suggestions. I appreciate the input that they provide. They provide a great sounding board for our processes. And specifically, I would like to thank Janice Deisinger for her persistence and her efforts to make elections better in Multnomah County. Without our observers, I think our process would suffer. And I just wanted to go on record as saying that we really appreciate them in Multnomah County. And as a matter of fact, I have here her signature on the certification form that we use to certify that the ballots have been sealed and locked up until they can later be counted and destroyed. The clerks and election officials around the state take ballot security very seriously and support the addition of additional ballot accounting measures to the statutes. Thank you for your time.
Okay. Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, Steve Trout, State Election Director. Secretary Brown has submitted a letter to you all. She apologizes for not being able to be here in person, but the letter reflects her position in support of House Bill 4174 and specifically the -3 amendments. I just want to say for the record, thank you to Representative Olson, Representative Garrett, and Representative Wingard. Near the end of the session last year, we were discussing this same topic, and there was some misinformation around, and so we were able to put together a working group to go over the different issues and to work towards a solution that would provide more secure, more transparent, and a better accounting for all ballots throughout the entire process. And working with the county clerks and those legislators, I think we've accomplished that. And it's disappointing that we would come here today and that this bill that will provide for greater security, greater transparency, and accounting of ballots will not be moving forward. I want to make it really clear. People continue to quote 254-483, but they leave out a few words. It doesn't say that all unused ballots should be destroyed at 8 o'clock. It says the county clerk shall destroy all unused absentee and regular ballots in the county clerk's possession. What about provisional ballots? What about vote-by-mail ballots? What about military and overseas ballots? What about duplicate ballots? None of those are included here. It's really a relic from polling place elections. Ballots have not been destroyed at 8 o'clock in this millennium. And so we're not talking about changing the process. Ballots have not been destroyed since we had polling places. We're trying to clean. I came here last year saying this was cleanup language, and that was my intent and full belief. And now here we are again, still discussing what, in my mind, is cleanup. I really believe that what we've been able to put together with the Dash 3s improves security and transparency, which is good for the process. Any time that we talk about destroying ballots, it makes it impossible to recreate that election during a recount or a contest. And so I don't believe any ballot should be destroyed until after the period to request a contest has passed, just in case there are any issues, so that we can recreate that ballot and prove and show to the public where the ballots are and account for each one of them to be able to validate those totals. If there are any ballots that have been destroyed, I cannot provide that accuracy to you. Mr. Chairman, you recognize the chain of custody from your days in the state police, and, mm-hmm. and it's really a similar issue here. With respect to one of Ms. Fromm's issues with respect to the confidentiality of this report, that was a drafting error, and the Dash 3s correct that. Absolutely, this report needs to be public so that the public can have confidence in what those lists are. And again, we want to provide each county upon certification will provide a list of the number of ballots printed, the number of ballots mailed to voters, the number of ballots issued to voters at the office of the county clerk, the number of ballots that come back undeliverable, the number of rejected ballot envelopes, the number of tallied ballots, the number of ballots used for duplication, the number of test ballots, the number of archived ballots. There are a number of different categories, and the accounting processes that our county clerks go through are very complex, double, triple, quadruple, and more checks to make sure that they get the right answer, they get the right vote totals. And they are dedicated public servants, and I appreciate the diligence that they go through this process. One other thing that the Dash 3s would provide for is it goes through and does some more cleanup in the 253 sections of the ORS, which deal with absentee ballots. Obviously, we're an entirely vote-by-mail state, so there really are no more absentee ballots. And so we've gone through to try and clean up those sections and accurately distinguish our long-term military and overseas voters from absentee voters, which we had before we went entirely vote-by-mail. So, again, I think we're here in support of the Dash 3 amendments to this bill and the bill as a whole to provide more security, more transparency, and more accountability for ballots throughout the entire process that will be able to be seen by the public to give them more confidence and understanding of the election process.
Okay. Questions? Okay, Steve, appreciate your work on this. So, gentlemen, thank you.
Thank you.
Before going further, I just want to make an announcement here regarding SCR 205, that's going to be moved to Thursday. So if you're waiting here to testify on that's going to be moved to Thursday. Oh, I'm sorry. Excuse me. That's SJM 201. Okay, and our next group, Janice Deisinger, Dan Meek, and Janice Thompson.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Olson and Co-Chair Kotek. I thank you for the opportunity to come before you and speak this afternoon. This issue that we all care about a great deal, and I'm just very excited to hear about our officials wanting to have our elections open to the public and have them become an open process. And I did sign Mr. Scott's certification of closure of the ballots and observe that, and I appreciate those efforts very much. It would have been very nice to have them counted before they went into the closet so that we could see that that count was the same at the end, but I did the procedure as he had ordered it and observed it, and I was very glad to have it, and I appreciate his efforts on that. Double accountability is a process that is used in a lot of institutions to show trustworthiness, and I think that's really something that we should go forward and try to accomplish. When I worked as a nurse, when we counted out drugs from one shift to the other, we would have one person count and the other accept, and you know, you have double accountability, and that feature, that function in business is a great tool to have, and I think we really ought to incorporate that more with the security of those ballots. When I observed the returned undeliverable ballots being destroyed, and I've done that twice now, sometimes it was 7 months after the election, and that's a very long time to make sure that a ballot stays in place. So I really would ask that as we consider that going forward, that we would put those returned undeliverable ballots. If they want to keep the envelopes, that's great. You've got a record. But let's take them out of the envelope and destroy those ballots. They come in, they come back early. We could get that done ahead of time or have them prepared. They could be counted, and I think prioritizing an election board to count those out ahead of time would be a good priority to have. And the other thing I wanted to say, I agreed with Wendy Froman and Ruth Bindle on the necessity to have the 254.483 in place. With those ballots not in play, it's just a cleaner process. I would also like to see that the measures that are put in place in the future have a reporting function for breaches in security to the public. That's one thing I think is really missing from this this process, the statutes. We don't know, the public doesn't know unless they observe a breach. So I've come in twice and saw something that we thought was a breach, and I reported it to the public best I could, but there's, you know, I am only there part of the time. So I think that it should be mandatory that any breach in the security be reported to the public, that they know what state their elections are in. And I agree with Andrew Nesbitt about our electronic devices that are used with to process the counting, that they should be examined in front of both parties or, you know, anyone within those parties so that it's an open procedure for examination, that malware is not inserted anywhere. Counting and storing of ballots should not be a secret. It's not a mystery. It's a process. So there were a couple of things I had questions about. There's a lot of stuff included in this bill. It was really a challenge to go over in a short amount of time. And I would like to see the language just streamlined an awful lot. Thank you for your attention and time. I appreciate your hard work on all this issue very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Janice? Okay, Dan, you're on.
Yes. Thank you, co-chairs. I'm still Dan Meek, and I've heard concerns, as you have as well, about having tens of thousands of unvoted blank ballots stored at election offices while the count is being done. These are the undeliverable ballots that are returned by the post office. I don't understand why those are returned to the county election offices and don't go to a repository elsewhere, perhaps one managed by the state police, until the election is over and done with. That would be a way of removing tens of thousands of unvoted blank ballots from the election offices.
Just, did I hear you correctly? You were thinking about wanting the state police to... Lord have mercy. Okay, all right, Janice.
Well, Mr. Co-Chair, someone other than the county election offices would be a place for the repository of the undeliverable ballots.
Janice Thompson, Common Cause, Oregon. And I have no suggestions related to the duties of the Oregon State Police. I understand the bill's not moving. As it develops further, I want to recognize that it would build on the hard work of folks who have been mentioned, Representative Olson, Garrett, and Wingard, and as well as the clerks and the Secretary of State's office. I think it is a good bill to move along. I concur with, you know, the reading of the statutes and the conflicts as described earlier by Tim Scott and Steve Trout, and think that this bill does kind of both modernize, kind of, you know, especially with the Dash 3 amendments, kind of, you know, kind of remove archaic language since we're now all vote by mail, and provide the, you know, meet the security goals in while also ensuring accountability of the elections and recounts and things like that. That, you know, the sweet spot has been achieved, I think, in this bill because of the hard work. I think it's important to emphasize that the Dash 3 amendments do reflect that drafting error about that report being public record. So it's actually disappointing the bill's not moving forward. Hope that all this hard work will not be in vain down the line. And finally, just want to really put on the record a belief that, you know, passing a bill like this is prudent due to an abundance of caution, but that is not required due to thinking that election results, you know, have been affected by the handling of these different categories. Just that kind of filters up, and I think there's lots of other reasons to take this bill, and, you know, some hinting that that's what's going on, I think, is inappropriate and really impugns the high level of professionalism of our county clerks.
Okay. Thank you. Questions? Okay, thank you. I'm going to close the public hearing on (clears throat) 4174, and we're going to move to work sessions and open up a work session on 4170. Colleagues, this is a bill that we'd heard earlier. It deals with the usage of dogs and training on EFU land, basically. And we have received fiscal and also revenue, so basically we're ready to move the bill.
Did we move an amendment?
Yes. We moved the Dash 1s the other day.
Okay, they have been moved.
And I do think the fiscal that Cheyenne gave us, it reflects the Dash 1s, no revenue impact. And
so if I could have a motion.
Chair, I move House Bill 4170 as amended to the floor with a two-pass recommendation.
Representative Hovey moves House Bill 4170 as amended to the House floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Seeing none, Amy, would you call the roll, please?
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Beyer?
Aye.
Representative
Estrada? Aye.
Representative Freeman?
Yes.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Winger?
Excused.
Excused.
Vice Chair Berger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Holby?
Aye.
Co-Chair
Olson? Aye. House Bill 4170 passes, and Representative Hovey, will you carry it with me then?
Certainly.
House Bill, okay. And as soon as our administrator gets back, we'll kind of catch her up to speed on that one. And before we go any further, we're just waiting right now for the next bill, which is House Bill 4172, so if you just stand at ease for a few seconds. And I'm going to open up a work session on House Bill 4172. And Cheyenne, if you'd share where we're at with the revenue.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4172. The Dash 3 amendment is up for consideration today, which restates the enforcement focus of this bill in more general terms and modifies the requirements that the State Patrol and the Health Authority consult periodically to maximize program qualification. We just received the fiscal and information about the revenue during the hearing today. Statement issued on the Dash 3s that is indeterminate, and the revenue... There should be no revenue impact, excuse me, and I spoke directly with the economist, and he released a document, but it has a typo. It lists the Dash 2. I can represent verbally, and if any of the members have any difficulty, we can wait longer and get the typo fixed, but it is a no revenue impact, indeterminate fiscal on the Dash 3s.
Yes,
Okay, members, the Dash 3s that you have in front of you, there has been a number of folks that have worked and done some hard work with this over the last few days, and Oregon Health Authority, as well as the folks representing tobacco industries, have come to agreement in the language that we have there that would be very effective with what we really want to do overall. So, do I have a motion? We're in work session.
Mr. Chair, move the Dash 3 amendment.
Representative Garrett moves Dash 3 amendments into House Bill 4172. Is there any discussion? Yes, Representative Freeman.
Just real quick, and I know you're trying to move through this. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the efforts of everybody to work on this amendment, which really does truly reflect what the people came and testified about this bill wanted. So this is going to do exactly as if the testimony given asked for. So I'm very happy with the work. Thank you. I apologize if I made a big deal out of it, but I really like when the intent of the bill and the bill match. Thank you.
Very good.
Question, Mr. Chair.
Yes, President Holley.
Do we know if this amendment will impact the ability of this program to qualify for federal funds?
It will not impact that, but it will actually, it is designed in a way to be able to open that door for Oregon Health Authority to move forward in application for federal funds. And I think it was tested, I can't remember now, but right offhand, but it was up in the neighborhood of close to $7 million that was available. Okay, any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Garrett?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I move House Bill 4172 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, thank you.
Subsequent take and remove from it.
Representative Garrett moves House Bill.
Does this need to go somewhere else?
Mr. Chair, members, there is a subsequent referral to Ways and Means by prior reference. That's correct.
Yes. May I amend my motion?
Excuse me. Yes.
There's a special way to say that. What do I have to say?
Well, the subsequent referral, too.
Don't we say to the floor, though?
No. Yes.
Yeah. Somebody else make the motion.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 4172 as amended to the floor for the due pass recommendation and the subsequent referral to Ways and Means by prior reference.
I understand that.
Okay. Representative Hovey moves that House Bill 4172 as amended to the House floor with subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Any discussion? Amy, would you call the roll, please?
Aye.
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 Representative
Freeman?
Yes.
Representative
Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Winter?
Which one?
What number are we
on? 4172.
72. Amended.
Yes.
Very good.
Yes.
Go by Chair Holby.
You just voted for last time.
I would blame him.
Be careful with that.
Aye.
Aye. Okay, House Bill 4172 passes. And we'll close the work session on 4172. And let's open a work session on SCR 205, which we've already heard testimony on. And at this point now, would... Yes, Representative Barnhart.
Is it a motion in order?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, I move that SCR 205 be sent to the floor with a do adopt recommendation.
Okay. Representative Barnhart moves SCR 205 to the House floor with a be adopt recommendation. Discussion. Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none. So ordered. And we'll close the work session on SCR 205, and Representative Nolan would like to carry that.
Thank you.
Okay, and then we're going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 4176.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4176 replaces Declaration of Public Safety Services Emergency with Declaration of Fiscal Emergency, permits governing body of county to request declaration of fiscal emergency in writing of the governor, describes qualifying fiscal distress as current or near future, compromised ability to provide minimally adequate services required by state law, establishes review procedure, establishes fiscal assistance board, composition, staff, duties, and authority to comply with Home Rule Charter. If applicable upon declaration, establishes fiscally distressed counties fund, requires 50% contribution toward administration costs from distressed county, requires rescission of declaration upon finding restoration of minimally adequate state-required services, declares an emergency is effective on passage. There is also a dash one amendment before you that the Sheriff's Association submitted in the hopes of it's being discussed today to include as among the persons appointed to the Fiscal Assistance Board, the county sheriff and the county DA as ex officio members of the board.
Okay, thank you. So we have three people who have signed up, Mike MacArthur, Daryl Fuller, and Alex Kyler. And I don't know which one of you would like to start first. Okay.
Chair Olson, members of the committee, Mike MacArthur, Association of Counties. This bill comes to you from the Joint Legislative Task Force on County Payments, and it's also a recommendation of the 2009 Task Force on Federal Forest Payments and County Services, number 53. And number 53 contemplated that the state should pursue legislation to establish financial control boards and other procedures to deal with counties in fiscal distress. As a first step, the state should authorize standards and procedures for the declaration of a public safety emergency. That was done in Senate Bill 77 in 2009. We've been consulting with counties, working with them on the problems that they're facing as they go forward. We think the tool that was established through Senate Bill 77 needs to be expanded in order to be able to deal with this crisis. What I've passed out to you, what you're receiving there is an opinion from Legislative Council about what a county is mandated to do. Because counties can't, there's no provision for bankruptcy in Oregon statute. So counties will ratchet down their services based on the revenues that are available. At some point, they will fail to meet the requirements of state statute in certain service areas. So how do we deal with that? That's the problem. The Federal Forest Payments Task Force recommended four steps. The second step was to bring in this financial review board. So 4176 expands what we had with public safety, which is where most of the problem is going to be, to other services. But you also have to worry about public health, tax collection, elections, for instance. And so this bill expands the perspective to more services. It's broader. It also makes the process prospective, so that once a county begins to see in its budgeting process that it's going to end up at that place where it's not meeting the level of service required by law, you can begin to plan for how you're going to deal with it. So getting ahead of the problem. It respects the authority of charter counties in terms of the decision-making of the board, and it requires a double majority. Essentially, the Board of County Commissioners and the Financial Control Board is appointed would both have to agree before any plan was put in place. That's in essence what it is. It's another tool that may be helpful, will be helpful, as we go forward in this uncharted territory of county finance. I urge your support.
Questions? Okay. Daryl? Or with you guys?
Why don't you go ahead?
Okay.
Chairman Olson, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Alex Kyler, Lane County's Intergovernmental Relations Manager. You do have a piece of testimony in front of you from me. Lane County has long been concerned about the state of its affairs in a post-Secure Rural Schools Act world, which we're now in. The then chair of the Board of County Commissioners, Bobby Green, was the chair of the or co-chair of the County Payments Task Force back in 2008-2009. When House Bill 4176 was really in its infancy, it came out of the Government Efficiencies Task Force. Lane County was also involved in the initial crafting of that concept. So we're quite pleased to see this measure before you today. As Mike indicated, it does provide a sort of a broader platform from which to jump into some assistance for counties. And Lane County, our administrator has directed departments to take a 25% haircut as they go into this next budget season. So it could be, depending on the language that comes out of this bill, that this would be an opportunity for us to seek some assistance and sort of gracefully go into this process. My testimony does suggest that term state required services is not well defined in the bill, and we offered up that we would refer to the document that I believe Mike provided to you, which was authored by your legislative counsel. There's a very similar document that also came out of Curry County, authored by their county council with regards to state mandated services, and we believe that's the place to look for this concept of state required services.
Daryl.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Daryl Fuller on behalf of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. And for the record, as a registered lobbyist, I'm an honorary member of the CYA party. We were talking about initials of parties earlier on and what the initials meant. Never mind.
Okay. All right. So, I'm just trying to figure out what CYA meant.
Oh, I know what that
other than normal term.
Mr. Chair, we understand.
Mr. Chair, you'll find that in the caption at the bottom of the ballot.
I'll look for that next time. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Chair, we understand the purpose of the bill and the idea of broadening a public safety crisis to a fiscal crisis, and we certainly don't oppose that, but we believe that a fiscal crisis would necessarily include a public safety crisis, so we don't understand why the bill would then remove the sheriff and the county DA from the fiscal crisis committee. We believe that they would be an integral part of that committee. We've worked to try to find out why they were removed, or if anybody had a particular reason why you'd want to remove those people from that committee, and nobody has been able to say that this is the reason why, or taken credit for, yeah, we don't want them in there because of this. So we're unless we hear otherwise, we're assuming it was just an error or a misunderstanding to remove them from the committee that would deal with this, not only a fiscal crisis, but with a public safety crisis. So with that in mind, we hope that the Dash 1 amendments that would add the sheriff and the district attorney back into that mix would be considered a friendly amendment in terms of the purpose of the bill, because you want those people in the room when you're trying to figure out what to do when a county's in crisis. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Freeman.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, and thank you guys for being here. And please don't take these comments or questions the wrong way, because I know there's been a variety of efforts to try to get this fixed. The one thing I consistently struggle with is we talk about the loss the school rules or the Secure Rural Schools Act, not the timber receipts. Somehow we've disconnected the problem from the cost. The problem is not from losing the welfare from the Rural Schools Act. The problem is we're not managing our natural resources. We were talking about counties that have some of the most abundant natural resources in our country cannot sustain themselves because of political policies, not because the trees aren't growing. So I just don't want to let that be lost in this conversation as we're talking about the very difficult decisions of counties becoming insolvent and the choices we have to make to keep them. Let's please keep connected the reason why these counties are becoming insolvent and not get something hung up in the middle about some federal legislation about some welfare payments. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I may, thank you, Representative Freeman, for that comment. And it certainly is true that this can't be solved in any one way. And the report essentially identified three major components of any solution, and forest management is one of the three legs of the stool. And if you'll tune in tomorrow at the Federal Forest Payments Task Force, you'll hear a proposal that would help move us in that direction.
Yes, okay. Representative Berger.
Is there any comment from the other two on Mr. Fuller's amendment and how the sheriffs and the DA got dropped, and is there an opinion on that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, we didn't do it.
you would say that. I mean, it's the sheriffs and the DAs after all.
We have no objection. The sheriff, as Mr. Fuller said, any conversation about fiscal distress is going to have to involve those folks, because that's where the problem is going to show up.
Thank you.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at this constitution of the board, which I guess is the point of the Dash 1 amendment. And if I read it correctly, what it basically does is it sets up a whole bunch of non-voting members. It sets up four voting members appointed by the governor, and it includes as voting members all of the members of the governing body of the county, which I assume we're talking about the county commissioners or the county court. So in some counties that would be three. In some counties it would be five. I suppose in other counties it might be more than that. I don't know how many board members there are in some home rule counties. So in the way the original bill is written, the governor's appointees would have control, if I understand this correctly, of this board, because there are only three members of the county board, of the county court, and four appointed members. In a county like Lane County, where there are five commissioners, the commissioners, assuming they voted together, could have control of the board because there are nine members altogether that have votes. And now if we amend this to add the district attorney as a voting member, at least that appears that that's what we're talking about, and the sheriff as a voting member, then the county always has the control of the board. I have to say I'm wondering what the point of this board is if we have, is the object of this board to somehow or another change the political mix in the discussion about these budgets, or is it something else? And if so, is it purely a matter of accident that in some counties the governor's appointees would be a majority and in other counties the local elected officials would be a majority? What's the point of it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, in Section 2, number 3, bottom of the page, it specifies that in order for a plan to be adopted, it must be a double majority. In other words, it has to be a majority of the appointed members and a majority of the county board. We have some constitutional issues with charter counties about other folks making decisions on their behalf. This is a work group, I think, and that's the spirit, is to bring in outside expertise, to get the state involved in what eventually may be their problem. The fourth step of the that's envisioned here is county dissolution. And if that's the path you're on, then the state needs to be involved. because they'll have to pick up the pieces.
Thank you. I had, Mr. Chair, I had missed the part about the double majority. Now all of a sudden it makes sense. I appreciate that.
Well, Mike, you just said something, though. You mentioned that it sounds like your thoughts, anyways, is that it's designed to be a work group. But I'm reading it more than that, than as just being a work group.
Mr. Chair, that may be oversimplification, but I think the idea is to come up with a plan that can work for that county. It may be that they need to recommend legislation back to you. It may be that they have to recommend to the voters that they take up the question. It may be reorganization of some of the internal functions of the county, maybe regionalization. You know, there are a number of things that can come of the development of a plan. And so I think that's what this is really focused on, is let's get a plan. Let's figure out how we're going to deal with this.
Okay. What is it? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, you're going to close public hearing on House Bill 4176, and I'm going to members move it to Thursday.
Mr. Chair, I move to suspend the rules for the purpose of allowing Representative Winger to vote on House Bill 4170.
Representative Hovey moves to suspend the rules to allow Representative Winger to vote on House Bill 4170. Is there any objection? Seeing none, so order. And Representative Winger, how do you vote?
Aye.
He votes aye.
Does it now pass? Reluctantly. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Pass. We'll close the work session on that. Okay. Just heads up. If you remember, we moved a committee bill that is, Ramona has that right now in her possession. We will need to move quickly with it on a memorial resolution honoring the Department of Corrections officer that was killed over near Pendleton. The honor guard from Department of Corrections is going to be here Thursday. So what that means is, because of that, we have to expedite a little bit. We will need to meet for about 10 minutes tomorrow, immediately after floor session. And do you have a room then?
It's, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this room here in room C, but it's at 1 o'clock for 10 or 15 minutes, not immediately after the floor session. Oh. And it is pending. No. It is pending permission for the extra meeting from the chairs. They technically have to approve having an extra meeting. It is at the chief clerk's request. This is LC 318, which was introduced and is pending re-referral to this committee. The committee hasn't yet moved it. The purpose of the quick meeting is to make sure that it can make it all the way through the process. And the chief clerk can accommodate with scheduling if we have a 10-minute meeting tomorrow. 10:15.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Barnhart,
Committee on Revenue meets at 1 o'clock. We have work sessions in that committee. I don't think it'll take an hour, will it?
Well, yeah. I think you could move this bill without us if you have everybody else.
Yeah.
If they can move the bill without us.
If I have six people, I can move the bill.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's true. Thank you. But just so you'll know that
if you need us to come down and vote, one of us could tear down here and vote.
Some of us probably won't be here tomorrow because we have another committee.
It has been approved? Okay. So. Yeah. We've got 1 o'clock.
And 1 o'clock
do you
in
know
here in room C, this room.
Okay, 1 o'clock
we're
tomorrow.
We're going to be right next door.
Here.
Yep, if you need us.
Oh, be sure.
We will post an agenda just as quickly as we can.
Okay, we are adjourned.
We also have a committee.